sometimes you run into interesting conflicts, like, you know, hey, we have this number of people to do the bills, we have this set of goals for the quarter, and we have these ideas that are really interesting and unique, and no one's doing these. How do we split up the time between those two? How do we prioritize? And it just becomes this very passionate discussion and debate even, which are actually a lot of fun to be a part of. We're constantly ordering and triaging and reordering things to make sure that at the end of the day, no one loses sight of the fact that whatever we do, the technology is a means. We are trying to move the business forward. My name is Rishi Dixit, and I'm the Chief Technology Officer at Yield Street.
This is Code Story, a podcast bringing you interviews with tech visionaries who share in the critical moments of what it takes to change an industry and build and lead a team that has your back. I'm your host, Noah Labhart, and today how Rishi Dixit architected a platform to change the way that wealth is created. All this and more on Code Story. Rishi Dixit was born and raised in India. He wrote his first program when he was 13 years old, and then he was hooked on computers. He comes from a family of teachers and bookstore owners, so he was kind of an outlier. And as a kid, having a computer was a luxury that his family couldn't afford. In his undergrad, he studied mechanical engineering, as computer science wasn't available. However, he brought in programming as much as possible. His graduate studies were completed at Cornell, where he worked side by side with Xerox scientists on interesting micro-mechanical system problems. Books have always been a thing for Rishi, loving the tactile sense of holding a book. He also enjoys a good whiskey, along with traveling. And he'd love to retire living in Scotland within walking distance of Lagavulin, if he can convince his wife to brave the winters in Scotland. He worked for Schlumberger for a while on robotic drilling tools, but then followed the activity in California around the time where the internet was evolving and Google was taking shape. He wanted to be a part of that. Towards the end of his time in San Fran, he worked in fintech, loving the connection between math, science, and software. He was the founding CTO of LearnVest, which was sold to Northwestern Mutual. And around this time of the sale, he met the founder of his current venture and joined the team as a consultant and then following as an advisor. During that time, he built out the makings of an alternative investment platform. In fact, the first of its kind. This is the creation story of Yield Street.
At the core of it, Yield Street is a first of its kind technology platform for alternative investments. Now, what does that exactly mean? So typically, if you're a retail investor, like most of the population here, our choices in terms of how we can grow our wealth or where we can park our money is limited to like your bank accounts, and then you have some fixed income investments, and you have some, you know, maybe public equity investments in the stock market. Whether it's for short-term income or most commonly for retirement, those are the options that have been traditionally available to retail investors. Now, if you are someone who can write much bigger checks of like $5, $10 million, you have a wealth of other opportunities available to you in private credit, in asset-based investments, whether it's real estate. Real estate is the only other asset class, if you will, that if you are at a certain point, you have the ability to, you know, whether you buy a house or get an investment property. But there's a large space of possibility out there, which is available to bigger check writers or funds or hedge funds or private equity firms. And Yield Street was born of an idea that this doesn't need to be that way. These are viable diversification opportunities that should be available to everyone, not just for the richest 1 or 0.1%. And especially coming out of 2007 and 8, when we saw all of our portfolios take a 50% dip, it was that moment where Bevin Lind and Michael were telling me their vision for Yield Street. It's like, hey, now that the passage of the Jobs Act in 2012 made it possible to open up these kinds of investments to a much more general solicitation, we can actually leverage the power of technology to make these kinds of investments available to a much, much broader audience. So that was the kind of the germ of the idea that created the company. So what we do is we provide these opportunities in various asset classes and real estate, in litigation finance and marine finance and art finance. We have built a technology platform that makes investing in these kinds of investment products as simple as you would, you know, say, instance, buy stock in Apple. So we wanted to level the playing field by using technology and the change in legislation that made this possible. What I believe sets Yieldstreet apart is we are not pinned to any particular kind of asset class, unlike many of the companies like Fundrise. These are great companies, Fundrise, Realty Shares, Realty Mogul. They tend to be focused in a particular kind of asset, like real estate. What we have built is the platform that is largely agnostic to the underlying asset class from an end investor standpoint. So you're able to come in and invest in a variety of different kinds of asset classes and access the same kind of opportunities that historically have only been available to bigger funds and more institutional investors.
Tell me about the MVP. So tell me about how long it took to build and what sort of tools you used to bring it to life.
From a coding and building standpoint, we had about a window of 6 to 7 weeks from a blank slate, like no line of code written, to a launchable MVP. So we started the brainstorming on the product. So one of the things that Yieldstreet, and this is kind of like a, for me, having spent a good amount of time in the startup world, was really refreshing and not very common to find, is we had a roadmap that Milan shared with me back in 2014 for what the platform can be over a span of like 3, 4, 5 years. Here we are, like almost 6 years in, and that roadmap has not changed. We haven't had to pivot. There was such a clarity of a true north for the company that even my most recent pre-Yieldstreet experience with LearnVest, we didn't have that. We had a mission, we had a goal, we had a vision, but the execution path was something that we were often kind of like, you know, making some runtime decisions on. From an MVP standpoint, we knew what we wanted to build, and we had a very good sense of how to sequence it, at least in the first year to 2 years. Our beginning started with a whiteboard, like many of us do, but what drove the MVP, or what goes into the MVP, is what are the signals you're trying to get? If you look at Yieldstreet from a platform perspective, they're effectively a marketplace, right? We connect retail investors looking for alternative investments with originators who are looking to raise capital to then lend out to borrowers, right? We wanted to focus on the investors, which we did. So what we wanted to build was a very streamlined, easy to understand onboarding and journey experience for our investors. In kind of conjunction with that, being as it was a slightly different kind of investment, we wanted to build a content base, a kind of like, we actually called it Yieldstreet University back then, an educational resource that informs potential users or investors of what are these, how do they work? So the MVP was kind of like very well shaped in terms of what can we build in about 6 to no more than 8 weeks that will not only provide a clear vision of to investors of what it is that the platform does, but also give us the data collection and the signals that we wanted to capture to figure out how the product roadmap evolves that point on. Because there's a lot of different things that we can potentially build. And obviously, with the kind of like, you know, resource limitations that we have in those early stages, we can't do it all. It doesn't even make sense to build it all at once. So what is the right sequencing? So we need to kind of capture the signals, the data, the insights that we want to glean from that MVP to decide which way to evolve in. So we focused on the investor. We kind of like put the back office automation stuff, which we knew we would build at some point at scale. We could put that aside. Like, let's not worry about that right now. Let's just figure out, if you were an investor coming into this kind of somewhat new world of investing, what is it that would get the user in, inform her, educate her on what this is, and provide a very smooth onboarding and investing experience? And that's what we doubled down on. And that's exactly what we launched with. We had a storefront with some initial investment offerings that we had already sourced. And we built some content around it. And we built a very streamlined onboarding flow and an investment flow. And everything else was offloaded to manual work because we didn't have any scale. What we benefited from was that clarity of where we want to end up in 4 to 5 years. Having that clarity is both critical and rare. It's hard to know. We had and we continue to have a clear vision of where this can and should end up in 5, 6, 7 years. What that allowed us to do in the MVP, aside from building the very basic set of things that we wanted to launch with, was build in some abstractions into the platform at that point. By which I mean, like, okay, well, at some point we want to automate the movement of funds. Okay, well, let's build a provider type abstraction where we can plug in a sort of dummy provider to pretend like the real thing is sitting behind it and moving the funds around. And then we actually eventually integrated with a payment automation provider. We just kind of plugged in that library or that service that we built into that provider abstraction. So we had some benefit there of forward-looking clarity that allowed us to kind of put the breadcrumbs in the MVP that we knew we would eventually go and build out kind of in a fully fleshed out way.
That makes sense. You had the vision and you had also some, you know, some experience from creating software, building solutions and things. You sort of knew how to lay the pieces out and then you abstracted the things that you thought you would need in the future. Dive in a little bit to maybe one or two of the decisions and trade-offs you had to make. So maybe around some of those abstractions that made life a little harder in the short term. And how did you cope with those decisions?
So let me take a very specific example. The kind of investment products that Yield Street offers, they are debt-based investment products, right? So they're sort of fixed income products. And like the public markets, which fluctuate, you know, these provide a more or less fixed yield over a certain period of time. Obviously, like every investment, there's risks and everything, but the debt-based investments, at the core of it, you have an engine that is calculating a payment schedule, right? You put in a certain amount of money into an offering and you have a payment schedule that defines how you would get payments based on the yield and term profile of that offering. So we could have done the, let's say, quote unquote, wrong thing and built out that entire engine for calculating the waterfall for the payments, but we didn't. We basically just captured the base parameters and we provided a way to sort of upload an externally computed waterfall into the system that could then be used to kind of drive the investment management part of it. And at that point, we were launching a product that was relatively new and unknown to the investment community, at least the retail investment community. We knew that at some point, if this takes off, this is going to be a bottleneck in scale. What can we build in the MVP that, knowing that this would need to be built out and fleshed out as a fully automated engine at some point, what are the kind of little bolts and nuts that we can put in that would make it not easy, but at least doable in a logical way? So that was one of the early kind of cutting corners sort of decisions that we made, that as soon as we started noticing the traction that we were getting on the platform, we went through a significant build of the actual engine that now powers all of our back office functions. And there was an interesting challenge there to build this at the same time, kind of manage the growing scale of the investor base. So, okay, we started off with like maybe whatever 10, 15 investors, and now we're suddenly scaling up to post 100 investors. Even with this engine, what is the minimal engine that we can build that will handle this influx of people, and then we can start building on top of it as the offerings got more and more complex. There was a period of time when we were building out the V1 of the engine, where we were kind of balancing out the actual tech effort required to build the engine and the back office manual effort that was required to handle the influx of investors that we were getting. It all worked out eventually because we started off with some assumptions or some invariants for the engine that we built in that didn't cover the long tail, but it covered the meaty part of the curve. Like, you know, 90% of our offerings were addressable by the V1 of the engine that we built. And the other 10%, we would still kind of sort of gracefully degrade to manual processing. as we started sourcing more and more interesting kind of products for our investors, they started getting more and more complex. And we actually had to go back to the drawing board a couple of years ago to kind of redo it from ground up to add in those levers of flexibility that we didn't have the time or the resources to build in the V1 of the engine. You can always, like in hindsight, you can always say, hey, if we'd made this configurable or that configurable, this would have been a lot easier. But sometimes you just kind of have to make a judgment call, you know, like, you know, well, we don't have nearly the scale or the variety of offerings right now to expand the technical effort with the team of four or five engineers that we have. Does it make sense to invest all that effort right now? Or should we just focus on growing our investor base and stay with the kind of offerings that we currently have? So this is a balancing act that continues today. You know, it never really goes away, and that's okay, you know.
So you kind of touched on how you progressed the product, but how did you go about building the roadmap of what's the next most important thing to build? And, you know, was that a customer feedback thing? Was it intuition? Was it a balance of the two? Walk me through that a little bit.
So it's actually a combination of different things. Ultimately, there's an underlying mantra that exists today and will exist forever. And like we're not blessed with Google or Facebook sized teams that can work on many, many different things at once. Mantra is always like, what moves the business forward? And that seems kind of like naive or simple enough, but it's actually tricky to draw, like connect the dots and draw the line from what are the KPIs that drives the business forward, whether it's the AUM on the platform, the number of investors, the number of new investors. What are we trying to hit on a quarterly or annual basis? Like, what are the key numbers that will demonstrate a healthy and growing business? And it kind of trickles down from there. Let's say, so there is a inventory, there is a backlog of, God knows, at this point, like close to two dozen different things that we want to build. Each of those things can be looked at and should be looked at from lens of what number is this moving the needle on if we build this right now. To take an example, right? You know, okay, well, we wanted to, let's say so right now the platform is primarily for what's called accredited investors. This is an SEC designation that requires you to have a certain, you know, financial situation, like whether it's income or net worth. Essentially, it's built in for investor protection by the SEC. So you need to make at least $200,000 in income on an annual basis for the last 2 years, or you need to have a net worth of $1 million to be able to invest in most of our offerings today. This is a friction point right now. It's one of the metrics that we are trying to hit is the number of investors, repeat investments, or new investors. What are the detractors from that? It's a number of different things. So, but there is a set of products that we are contemplating that will play a, without going into too much detail, the accreditation verification is a somewhat friction-filled process. It puts a bunch of requirements on the investor side to prove their accreditation. Now, if we can figure out a way, which we have, if we can automate that part, if we take that friction point away, it will actually reduce the churn of investors. So if we have a quarterly goal of increasing the number of active investors or reducing the churn in investors by X percent or having Y number of investors, we would prioritize this product that we know will directly impact that number. So ultimately, it kind of boils down to what are the different products that we can build that move the business forward. That's one. That's a big one. The second thing is, unlike 2015 when we started, there's a lot more players in this space now. They're doing interesting things. They're really good companies. So how do we stay on the cutting edge in terms of innovation? So that is the other key driver to how we order and prioritize our product roadmap. Sometimes you run into interesting kind of like conflicts, like, you know, hey, we have this number of people to do the builds, we have this set of goals for the quarter, and we have these ideas that are kind of like really interesting and unique, and no one's doing these. So how do we split up the time between those two? How do we prioritize? And it becomes this very passionate discussion and debate, even, which are actually a lot of fun to be a part of. where we decide, okay, well, this is going to take, you know, this is a quick win that we can quickly roll out, and we'll be able to kind of like create this very interesting feature on this existing flow that will delight our investors. So it becomes this math of like, what is the effort level and what is the impact, the perceived or expected impact of that? And we do this on a quarterly basis. We do this on a sprint by sprint basis. We're constantly kind of ordering and triaging and reordering things to make sure that at the end of the day, no one loses sight of the fact that whatever we do, the technology is a means. It's, we are trying to move the business forward, and we are trying to serve our investors the best we can. And at the same time, stay ahead of our competition.
Let's switch over a bit to team. Tell me about how you built your team and what you looked for in those people to indicate that they were the winning horses to join you.
That's a great question. And it's actually, I wish there was a nice 10-second soundbite answer, but really, my whole kind of outlook on this, both not just in Yield Street, but even in past similar leadership roles, has been just hire people that are smarter than you, you know, and smarter, and not just in terms of technical skills, because at this point I can safely say that the team that we have built here at Yield Street, they're collectively and individually much smarter than I am. It's just the reality. And beyond the raw technical skills, they have this itch, this passion, this constant desire and constant thirst to know more, to learn more, to explore. And if you get a set of people that embody this almost yearning to get better all the time, to constantly move their own knowledge as well as the platform forward, the next thing you do is simply get out of the way. Give them air cover and get out of the way. The team at Yield Street started much similar to many startups. We started building out a team in Brazil, which is still where we have the biggest chunk of our team. Unlike a classic kind of outsourcing relationship that typically companies tend to have, certainly bigger companies, they're a part of our team. They're fully empowered to make decisions, to provide input, not just on the technology, but also on the product itself. Like, ask questions like, why are we building this? Why are we building it this way? Why can't we do it that way? You get a set of really smart and driven people, and you give them, you empower them to have a voice in the decisions that we make. And you give them the space to do their best work. Nothing beats that. The amount of creativity that comes out of not just engineers, but, you know, designers and product people and data engineers. And we have what we call a PDT complex here at Yield Street, which is really product, design, data, and tech. And they're all like this one symphony. And me and my compadre on the product side, our chief product officer, our primary role is to provide some guidance, some direction, some rationale on where we're trying to go, what we're trying to do, and then essentially empower them to make the decisions that need to be made to drive both the platform and through the business forward. Obviously, we need to establish the technical competency. So we have our own coding challenges and like our screening process to just gauge the tech skills and tech chops. But beyond that, what we look for is like, hey, what do you do outside? Like, what are some of the most interesting things, products, systems that you build, that you've used, that you wish you had built? Let's pick one of those and tell me what you like about it. Tell me what you don't like about it, and how would you rebuild it? So kind of like tapping into that creative side of the team members and seeing what they can bring to the table beyond just the raw ability to design and code systems. And it's worked out really well. You know, if I look back on what I'm most proud of in terms of what I've built, certainly here at Yield Street, and I would argue the same thing with LearnVest, the platform's great, it's very forward-looking, it's very scalable and all that, that's wonderful. But it's really the team that we built here. They're the ones who move the company forward.
So let's talk about scalability then a little bit. Was this built to scale efficiently from the beginning, or is this something you're kind of fighting as you grow?
Of course, we had microservices from day one, and everything was just, you know, perfectly flowing between different... I'm just kidding. Listen, I sort of benefited from some hindsight of mistakes that I made in past lives, certainly in LearnVest days from a scalability standpoint. So I was able to avoid a bunch of those, just kind of bring those learnings from failures, which are obviously the best teachers ever. So was it built to be scalable from day one? I wouldn't say that because I honestly, anyone who says that is probably embellishing the truth a little bit. That said, there are certain touch points, some invariants that will guarantee lack of scalability, right? So we made sure to avoid those to the extent possible. So if you think about scale, so there's two different levels, actually three different levels of scale, but let's talk about the two main ones. One is just the platform scale itself. Can it handle an ever-increasing traffic? Is it built to go from like 100 investment requests coming in per second to 100,000 investment requests coming in per second? Was it built to do that on day one? No, it wasn't. Did we know how to evolve it to get to that point? Yes. So we left some trail markers in the early builds of the software to kind of like make sure that, hey, if you get to this point, make sure that this thing gets split out into a separate service that is asynchronous. So there are certain principles that we stood by, starting with the choice of the framework that we use. So the platform is largely a Java and Scala platform on the core side, and the data size is Python. But we made sure that some of the known bottlenecks to scale, relational databases, blocking calls, synchronous calls, were avoided as much as possible and only resorted to when there was no other alternative. Like, you know, okay, well, if you're logging in, that call probably needs to be synchronous just to know whether to let the user in or not. Does anything else anywhere in the overall platform need to be synchronous? Most likely not. So we put in a message broker from early days. We built in asynchronous processing from the very beginning. The way we did it evolved over time because, you know, aside from everything else, new technology became available that wasn't available when we started building it. But we put in the markers in the early builds to make sure it was built to eventually, it could be evolved to a more scalable platform. Were we successful? Yes and no. Some parts of it were, some parts we had to redo. But overall, I think we made some good choices early on from a framework and architecture standpoint that have benefited us today. Others, we had to go through a bit of a rebuild, maybe about a year and a half ago, where we took this almost paradigm shift in the architecture itself. Like we moved from having a more traditional kind of CRUD MVC sort of architecture to a more event sourced reactive architecture. We shifted the focus of the relational database away from being the source of truth to being a snapshot in time. And the source of truth is now our event journal. So it's kind of like this very beautiful concept, which frankly, I was not fully exposed to. And this kind of, it's an interesting tie back to the team. Some of the more senior architects in our team actually did a bunch of research and read up a bunch of interesting articles and said, hey, here's this framework that is built on top of our existing framework that forces us to build things in an event source reactive way. Let's switch to that as we start rebuilding pieces of our platform. We borrowed the time almost from the product gods and said, hey, give us a little time to do a little bit of refactoring around here so we can actually move to this new paradigm of building. And that will give us the right kind of scalability, which primarily translates to being able to scale purely with hardware. Software, if your software is not scalable, it doesn't matter how much you burn in monthly AWS costs. You're going to crash, which we did in 2017, which was kind of like our inflection point for re-examining our platform architecture and starting to make those structural changes. And then the other kind of scale is just human scale. Like we offloaded the building of back office software automation to a later point of time. Now we have tens of thousands of investors. Obviously, we're not going to be able, like, you know, we are at a point where unless the back office systems are largely automated, if not fully automated, we're not going to be able to handle that scale. So we actually started building out all of that automation 3 years ago. And now we are able to scale. We were able to scale to our current level and will be able to beyond this without having to scale our back office operations team to like hundreds of thousands of people. We have two people in our investment operations group that handle, you know, tens of thousands of investors and who knows how many millions of dollars in fund flows in all kinds of directions. So those were the things that we put in both from an architecture standpoint as well as a product roadmap standpoint. So it's like, hey, when we hit this inflection point, we should double down and start building out the automation, back office automation for this, so we can handle the operational scale of the platform, not just the architectural scale itself.
So as you step out on the balcony and you look across all that you've built, what are you most proud of?
It's my team. You know, it's, I really do like the state of the platform, the way it is today. It's a nice symphony of microservices, talking over Kafka and all of that, which is great. But it's all credit to the team that we've built here. That's the one thing that I'll be more proud of than anything else, because we are nothing without this team, and not just their technical abilities, but their raw passion and desire to build the best platform there is. You know, it all stems from there. So I like to say that, like, you know, I'm close to achieving my goal of making myself largely redundant. And if I can get to that point, I know I've done something right, because now the team that's assembled is equally invested and equally excited about doing the build and evolving the platform. I didn't need to drive them. They're self-driving, and I'm learning from them. I'm a much better engineer today because of the team that I've built, and I'm not even coding anymore.
Well, let's flip the script a little bit. Tell me about a mistake you made and how you and your team responded to it.
Well, we did use an OR mapping framework in the early days, and that's a little geek-specific answer. It was actually true. It was a mistake that I made in the MVP. Despite having told myself to not do that, because that's something that bit us in LearnVest days as well, I think a key mistake that I would say that I wish I had addressed earlier is less about the technology and more on the team again. As good as a team is, you're always going to have some misfits in the team, right? You know, for various reasons. Sometimes a competency gap. Sometimes they're just not good team players. We have had a small number of those, and I would say the mistake on my part was not addressing that situation as promptly as I should have, because, you know, it causes a general viscous drag on the entire team. Like, you know, even a single underperformer or not so much a team player will cause a drag on the team. And that's like the biggest mistake I would say from a Yield Street standpoint. In past lives, I made much bigger technical mistakes. But like I said, I was able to bring those learnings into Yield Street. So thankfully, not too many big mistakes on the pure technical front so far. Well, there's still time to make them.
So what does the future look like for the product and for your team?
We have our work cut out for us in many ways from a pure product and platform build out standpoint. So we started off the company with the mission and a vision of expanding investment opportunities to a much broader audience. Now, we barely scratched the surface of that. Right now, like I said, we primarily serve accredited investors, but we certainly do not want to stop there. We want to expand it to an increasing investor base beyond just accredited investors. So if you look at the typical financial life today in America, the point of time where you start getting enough or you accumulate enough investable capital to invest in these kinds of offerings has been, like, you know, even before Yield Street or companies like Yield Street came around, it would be like, you know, in the 60s, like, you know, when, you know, you're close to retirement almost. The mission has always been to pull that time in a person's age lower and make these available at an increasingly younger age so you can start growing wealth much sooner. And now how we achieve that is by expanding the suite of our products beyond what we started off with. So that is an ongoing mission. And as we speak, we are exploring about four or five, which I'm not at liberty to talk about in too much detail, but we are constantly looking to expand the space of products from a point of view of what audience we want to serve with those. What kind of diversification do we want to offer to our audience? Like, what kind of risk aversion do we want? What ranges of risk aversion do we want to provide across our suite of products? So that's kind of an ongoing thing. Newer and newer products, new kind of asset classes. Once we start building out these different kinds of products, the next thing to do is start connecting the dots between those products, so we kind of start segueing into things like advisory, financial planning, or making it more automated and self-driving, where investors wouldn't necessarily have to make their own choices of whether we want to invest in this art offering, that marine offering, but really more from a goal standpoint, like, you know, what are you looking for? Short-term income, long-term retirement, and then coming up with, you know, the kind of stuff that you see today with things like Betterment, but like really bringing it to the alternative investment space. And from a team standpoint, and of course, we want to go beyond serving just US-based investors. But there is also the other parties that the platform serves, the originators, our own internal stakeholders. Like, we build software for not just our investors, but also our investment operations group, our investor relations group. There's a ton of homegrown software that we build to serve our internal audiences. And so we continue building on those, increasingly automating their life so that they're able to better serve our investors. And all of this kind of translates into a scaling team on the product and tech side, where, you know, we today have a fairly lean team. As our stakeholder space continues to grow, we'll need to build more and more software, and we need to build teams that are kind of purpose-built for specific audiences. There's a lot more build left and a lot more audiences and users to serve. So I think we'll be fairly busy for the next 3 to 4, even 5 years.
Let's switch to you, Rishi. Who influences the way that you work? You know, CEO, a CTO, architect, really any person. Name a person you look up to and why.
Really, the set of people that I'm the most awed by are really the creators of this tech world that we know and live in. Like, you know, these are like unassuming geniuses that we really stand on their shoulders, like Brian Kernighan and Dennis Ritchie and Ken Thompson, Ben Cerf. They build the foundation. We would be nothing without them. Like, I was just recently hearing this podcast with Brian Kernighan, which frankly I didn't even know he was still alive, but it was fascinating to hear from him, like the early story of how Unix was created. And he just kind of like said it like, you know, yeah, he just made a cup of coffee. You know, it's like so humble and unassuming, and like nothing would be possible without the kind of work that these guys did in the 60s and the 70s. How it influences the way I work, I mean, I certainly would be way, way too presumptuous for me to kind of like draw any kind of line between me and that and these giants, but it really boils down to a simple thing. You gotta really, really passionately love what you do. Everything else just kind of like naturally falls into place if you have that. I don't even know what to say beyond that, but like, you know, it's really like these are my almost heroes, you know.
So if you could go back to the beginning, what would you consider doing differently, or where would you consider taking a different approach?
I've thought about this a lot. There was this paper, now it's kind of become a classic, but it was published in 2015 called Immutability Changes Everything, which is a nice, catchy, almost like clickbaity title. But it's a brilliant paper. What it talks about is really the shift in architectural paradigm that we introduced in the U3 platform not too long ago. If I were to dial back to 2015 and start building this platform again, I would build it in this event source reactive way of building systems. Like, I was weaned on this, right? You know, it's like I built software, I built web-based systems in the late 90s and early 2000s, when all of this, these were the theoretical concepts. No one had actually commoditized them to the point where we could start building real systems with those, or at least I wasn't aware of them. I would love to rebuild the platform from the ground up to the way it's evolved right now, where kind of like almost divorce the idea of your database, relational database, being your source of truth. If you'd said this to me 5 years ago, even, it's like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, what else can be the source of truth? But if you think about it if you think about systems from a real world perspective, the immutable, unshakable truth is the time series of things that have happened. That's immutable, that you cannot change history, right? These events happen. The way things appear at any given point of time are the consequence of a series of things that have happened to make it that way, right? So if you think of a relational database, which is a snapshot in time of a state of a system, and it's almost like counterintuitive now for me to think of that as the source of truth, when in fact the source of truth is not that. It's the series, the sequence of events that has led up to the database being in whatever state it is in. So that sequence of events, that log, your time series of events, is your source of truth, and it has to be, and it is, immutable. And if you make that your source of the truth, any snapshots in time can be reconstituted, can be recomposed simply by replaying the sequence of events. So theoretically, I can blow away my entire database today and replay the sequence of events from Kafka and get it back to exactly the state it was in before it was blown away. So this is kind of like a new way of thinking about systems. It has the added benefit of actually, A, having enough commoditized software that makes this possible with highly opinionated microservice frameworks like Lagom, and having a truly, truly industrial grade message broker like Kafka, which is a lot more than a message broker, actually. It's possible to do that. And these bits, the concept, these frameworks, these existed in 2015. I was simply unaware of them at that time. So that's one thing I would redo, because we are realizing the benefits of that architecture today, both from a point of view of scalability, observability, recovery from issues or failures. And it's just a beautiful thing to see. I wish I could do that right from the get-go.
You're getting on a plane and you're sitting next to a young entrepreneur who's built the next big thing. They're jazzed about it. They can't wait to show it off to the world. They can't wait to show it off to you right there in the plane. What advice do you give that person, having gone down this road a bit?
You know, it seems a tad presumptuous for me to give entrepreneurial advice to someone having not personally been an entrepreneur, but I have been on founding teams, and I'll give it a shot from that perspective. There's two things, really. One is, whatever it is that you're building, you've got to want it bad. Like, the passion for building comes in many ways, in large part, from wanting to use the product that you are building because it doesn't exist and you wish you had it. And this is kind of like a slightly different way of saying love what you're doing, but it's really about, you have to be your product's first user. It's not always possible if you're building an enterprise product, but I've mostly been in consumer facing products, so that's kind of my perspective a little bit. If you feel that, oh my God, I wish I had this. I feel that way about LearnVest. I feel that way about Yield Street. I wish I had Yield Street in 2008 when my IRAs dropped. Let's say that's a baseline, that's table stakes, right? Be very picky with your starting team. You are not gonna have all the skills needed to build the business. And that's okay, that's actually the way it should be. You know your strengths, but also you know your gaps. Based on the product that you're building, find true stars almost to fill in the gaps that you yourself have that you need to fill to build your product. To give you an example, if you're building an API play, right, and you're not a technical person, but you realize the benefit of having an API, the first person you probably want to hire in your founding team is a seasoned architect, or who can be a founding CTO. You probably don't need a CMO right in the starting team, but you definitely need that CTO who's built a SaaS product or an API product before. It's a lean team. You're gonna have a short window of time to demonstrate something to your audience, to the capital markets, everyone. So be very, very choosy about your starting team. And if you have a certain pool of money to spend, rather spend that on a really lean team of superstars who can help you realize your vision, rather than just getting a large team of engineers or designers that will build something that will look good, but really they're not invested or passionate about what it is that you're trying to do. Those are really, your starting team is everything. You can make or break your enterprise.
That's fantastic advice. Well, Rishi, thank you for being on the show today. Thank you for telling the creation story of Yield Street.
Thank you. This has been a really wonderful experience, and I really enjoyed chatting with you.
And this concludes another chapter of Code Story. Code Story is hosted and produced by Noah Labhart. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the podcasting app of your choice. Support the show on patreon.com/codestory for just $5 to $10 a month. And when you get a chance, leave us a review. Both things help us out tremendously. And thanks again for listening.
Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all-purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now. Save.